Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. If you have ever even looked in for a second in how to become a better negotiator, how to be better at influencing people, how to build trust in communication, you're going to run into the work of Chris Voss. His book, Never Split the Difference, is incredible. He's a former hostage negotiator, and really the skill set that we're talking about building that he developed through that work is a skill set that we need in all relationships. Now, look, if you're trying to get a deal on Facebook Marketplace, it's pretty good to read that book ahead of time. But the other thing is, if both of you, you and your partner, or you and someone you're dating, are trying to achieve something together, you're going to have competing needs, competing thoughts, competing feelings. Like, these things are not always going to be the same. And that's actually a beautiful thing about being in a relationship, that the other person is not you, right? And so learning these skills, being open to the influence of other people and being able to influence them, that's relating. And doing it not from a manipulative place, but from a place of collaboration. So with all that said, I'm so excited for you to hear or watch today's episode. Wherever you're getting this podcast, please hit the subscribe button so you don't miss any future episodes. And also the share button. Share it with someone who you think could really use some understanding of how to be a better negotiator, how to be a better communicator. And if you got sent this, it's only from love. All right, without further ado, here's the episode with Chris Voss. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today, I get to have Chris Voss on the pod. Welcome, man. I'm so excited to be chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you know, when I first got your book, I was actually negotiating on a car I was buying. And I had read your book. And so I was so excited to put into practice some of the stuff. And so I read quickly a little summary again. And I went into the negotiations and I crushed the negotiation. Like, I couldn't believe it. And I remember thinking, like, is this trickery? Is this magic? Like, what is happening here? And so, hey, for everyone listening, incredible book. It's called Never Split the Difference. And Chris, maybe you could just give us a quick background of, like, yeah, developing this skill set of negotiation and just the origins of it for context.
Yeah, well, I had a desire to become an FBI hostage negotiator, and I was eminently unqualified. And so to become qualified, I was given advice from a person I should listen to volunteer on a suicide hotline. You know, what's the phrase? Never take advice from somebody you wouldn't trade places with. On that place, you know, don't take direction from somebody who hasn't been where you're going. Tons of advice, but are they qualified to give that particular advice? So, yeah, and then it was emotional intelligence. It was operational emotional intelligence, operational empathy early on. And a lot of it was when I was on the hotline, I'm like, you know, why shouldn't everybody be the recipient of genuine understanding? Mm-hmm. And so I started applying in my personal life, my business life, using it across the board, you know, became a hostage negotiator, had experience negotiating literally all over the world. And found out that humans are wired pretty much everywhere you go the same. And we react the same across the board. So then when I got out of the FBI and I taught at Georgetown, at Harvard, and at USC, I wrote a book about it. And the book's done pretty well. And it's about relationships, really. Everybody, or to connect. Even if you don't necessarily want to have a relationship with somebody, you know, there's a desire to connect. And that works in your favor, regardless what the negotiation is.
Yeah, it seems like, you know, we don't tend to want to negotiate with people we don't at least have some connection to. Like, is that fair to say? Like, some sort of respect? Is it respect? Like, what's at the baseline of being open to influence?
Yeah, respect is an element. You know, it's an easy one. You don't have to like them to respect them. And you don't even have to be on their side. You don't even have to think you're going to collaborate with them. But yeah, because if you don't have some connection, some kind of connection in some way, then they are the other, they're a threat. They're always the adversary. And if you're talking to anybody, you have different aspects of the same problem. It doesn't matter what it is, even in a terrorist negotiation. you are faced with different aspects of the same problem. So you're going to come up with a better outcome if you can find a way to collaborate on some level.
Did you find when you did your training with the FBI that like actually being in the job, did you end up learning a ton more? Like, did you end up having to be like, that training was kind of incomplete? Like, there's actually a whole ton more that you were learning in real time.
Oh, there's always, you're always learning. There's endless novelty to use a term. I'm listening to a podcast the other day, and even within the confines of anything, if you continue to learn it, there's endlessly things to learn about it. So yeah, and I love to learn and get better. I love to think that I can pull stuff off that other people can't invisibly, you know, give me the spells from Hogwarts and nobody knows I'm using them. And it's endlessly fascinating. Everybody on my team, we have the best time.
Yeah. When you started to look at the overlap, like what do you see as the correlations of romantic relationship dialogue with the things that you navigated?
Because it's human connection. I pick up information from everywhere. And one of my favorite sources of information on neuroscience is Andrew Huberman's podcast. But then I'm listening to him discuss relationships on one of his podcasts. Now, I knew that serotonin was triggered by the feeling of being understood. And there's just because I understand you doesn't mean that you feel understood. And there's a whole lot of crap out there. You know, I understand in the history of mankind, never made anybody feel understood, or the feel, felt, found thing. You know, I know how you feel. I felt that way too. Here's what I found. That doesn't work either. That doesn't make people feel understood. But when someone feels understood, then it triggers oxytocin. Now, I knew that already, that oxytocin was a bonding drug, but then I'm listening to Andrew's podcast, and he says that oxytocin inclines people to tell the truth, hence the honesty of pillow talk after an intimate encounter. Everybody knows that happens, you know, people after shared intimate moments. Well, oxytocin is a truth serum. And so I'm constantly studying these neurochemical responses in people across the board, and they apply to romantic relationships.
Yeah, it makes sense too, because, you know, for a lot of people, I think especially men, the way that they feel connected is intimacy, maybe because they didn't have other emotional skills or weren't socialized to be able to be as emotive or emotionally intelligent.
Well, and let me interrupt you there, because it's socialized principally, you know, the nature versus nurture conversation. You get a lot of debate about nature between males and females. And I haven't seen anything really definitive. I've seen a lot of stuff implied. But there's no question that women tend to be nurtured to be more soft skills aware at a much earlier age than men do. You know, a little boy gets into a problem. Dad says, go back and fight it out. A little girl gets into a problem, and the older females are like, look, you can't always fight. You're going to have to find a smarter way to handle this. And so there's more nurturing for soft skills, I think, for women earlier than for men.
I can't remember where I read it, but I remember reading that oxytocin has a shorter half-life in men.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so the thought process.
That's possible.
Yeah, the thought process was that maybe how it interacts with higher levels of testosterone. I can't remember. I wish I could, because it's so relevant to what we're saying. But it was how men after intimacy don't build as long of a bond. And so that is thought to be the process of why. And well, of course, also for women, if they're intimate with someone, there's the potential for pregnancy. So the bond is almost required to be a little longer. So it was like, I just remember that being an interesting thing about short-term relationships and how they have a different biological impact on both genders.
That could be the case. That's interesting. I'm gonna keep my eyes peeled.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it. I'll fire it over to you. In your book, you talk about tactical empathy, and I thought, okay, this is really interesting, because like, how do we use this in romantic relationships, intimate relationships, to navigate disagreements without compromising? You know what I mean?
Yeah, because compromise is a bad idea. I'm a last century guy. So back in like the 1970s, 1980s, I remember this cartoon, newspaper cartoon. There were always one panel and one line. It was called The Lockhorns, and the Lockhorns were a husband and wife. and the husband saying to the wife, let's compromise. That way we'll both be unhappy.
Oh, that's good.
And so, you know, that's the reality. So, but to understand. Now, the danger with the intimate relationships are the more exposure you've had to somebody, the more likely it is that you've wounded them inadvertently to start with. Mm-hmm. And so then that becomes a little bit of a double whammy because you've hurt them. They know they've been hurt. And the fact that you're oblivious to it is an additional hurt.
Yeah, so true.
And I think that's what happens in romantic relationships. I think that's what happens in families between siblings. Like, yeah, the longer you've been around somebody, the more likely it is you wounded them. You didn't even know. You didn't mean to. And if you knew, you'd love to make amends. And that's why those things are often very difficult to find out. So what do you do with empathy? You approach them showing that you could say, look, I know I've hurt you and I don't even know it. I know I've hurt you in ways that I'm oblivious to. And on top of that, that makes me even dumber for being oblivious to the stuff that should have been obvious that I should have figured out. These are the kind of conversations that are required in intimate relationships because it's the reality of the situation.
I like how you frame it, that you might not even know that you have hurt them. And just by acknowledging that it exists, that the more time, which I've never heard that stated in that way, that of course, the longer you are in relationship with someone, the more likely you have inadvertently hurt someone. Of course. How do you create the baseline as a couple that even the inadvertent hurts? Do you think it's beneficial to have a constant conversation about like what has felt harmful in a relationship just to always keep that part excavated then?
I don't know that you need to have a constant conversation about it.
It might get
because
tired.
among those challenges, you know, we go through through the given course of a day, we might be schizophrenic. Like the Chris Vosser wakes up early in the morning, an hour after I've been up, I'm fully caffeinated. You know, I'm optimistic. I can handle the day. Versus a Chris Voss an hour before I go to bed when I'm worn out. I mean, these might be two different human beings. And so I'm trying to be more conscious of not trying to excavate sensitive conversations late at night when I'm more likely to be in a negative frame of mind, which means I'm dumber. I saw on a completely believe in this. Sean Acker did a TED talk some time ago now. I think it's The Happy Secret to Better Work. Sean Acker is a Harvard psychologist, which normally those are two strikes against somebody, in my opinion. But brilliant dude and entertaining TED talk, which means it's short. But he says you're 31% smarter in a positive frame of mind. I'm all in on that stat.
Yeah.
So if that's true, then that means you're at least 31% dumber in a negative frame of mind. Which means if I'm trying to have a discussion with somebody that I care about, when I'm in a negative frame of mind, the chances of me saying something really stupid that I'm going to regret are much higher, or overreacting. You didn't refill the dog's water bowl again. Why do you always do that? And if in the morning I get up and I see the dog's water bowl isn't full, I'm like, wow, maybe that's one of the things that I love about her. Maybe that's a quirk, that's a feature, not a drawback. So being careful when you excavate those conversations, you got to be conscious of that.
Yeah, I think that every time I see a dish in a sink, not in the dishwasher, and I always think like, my wife's so amazing in so many ways. This is a beautiful quirk. I've been thinking that because it's in her. Of course, I have things that she's like, Mark, it has so many great, this one thing. Like I always joke that, I'll take a jacket and just put it on top of a chair, but eventually the chair becomes the closet. And so that's definitely a point of contention sometimes. I'm curious in all your work, because you dealt with such high tension situations. How do you recommend managing that nervous system stress, that dysregulation? Because you're like talking to people that are in life and death moments and you're communicating from such a high level of strain and stress that I'm like, that's got to be a lot harder than just handling a dialogue with a romantic partner. So I'm curious, what could you recommend to the listeners for how do we take what you've learned and apply it in these very high stress what are seemingly triggering where our brain shuts off, the 31%, I think you said?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple things. And it's the difference between striving for excellence or striving for perfection. Perfection's impossible, and it's a fool's errand. And seeing the subtle difference in human beings' approach, if it's impossible, it's a guarantee to be unhappiness, for unhappiness. Or when you fall short of perfection, which you will, you're gonna kick your own tail. And so, first of all, it's your attitude. Am I trying to get better? Or am I trying to be perfect? Just try to get better, which means you forgive yourself for mistakes. So a little bit of a mindset. Secondly, a belief in a process. But then, you know, you got a great process. Always be looking to improve the process. There's a lot of chatter in our head. I came across a book recently called Chatter. Now, everybody knows that, you know, whatever the figure is, I've heard 10,000 conversations a day in our head to 50,000. So I don't know what the number is. It doesn't really matter. The important issue there, though, is it's repetitive. Like most of those thoughts, those conversations are not original thoughts. They're repetitive. So what if you could get behind that chatter instead of saying, geez, this is going wrong again. You say to yourself, you know, I tend to be lucky. I'm worried about how this is going to work out. You know, I'm a hard worker. We tend to over notice the negative because that's the way we're wired. So you need to get behind your chatter to build yourself back up. And the greatest athletes have it mastered. That's what made them great. I'm seeing a post recently. I can't remember the psychologist's name, but he said the top five tennis players in the world, their internal chatter is radically different from the next 20. And the top five tennis player in the world, he misses a shot. And he says, you know what? I miss that one, but I'll get the next one. This is exactly where I want to be. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. Now, the next 25... work harder. You know, you could do better than that. They're kicking their own ass. So you can be in the top 25 in the world with negative chatter, but you cannot get into the top five unless you reorient that chatter. And to me, this is the challenge. And this is, if you want to be top five, and there are plenty of great coaches that'll put you in the top. Hell, the top 50. You be the top 50 in the world. I've coached players in the top 50. Have you coached anybody into the top five? Because the data is starting to show us this chatter thing is really important. And it's something I stumbled over recently, and I'm working on a lot of regular basis. The power of this makes all the difference in the world. And that's your original question is, how did I cope with the high-stress situations? I had a process I believed in. I didn't require myself to be perfect. I knew sometimes things go bad. And since I believed in it, and I always felt it was a privilege to do my old job, then that kept me in a positive learning frame of mind.
I don't think we often consider the idea of building like a champion's mindset in terms of romantic or familial relationships. You know what I mean? Like, it makes sense though, because if you can get control of that self-talk, I think so many of us end up dysregulated because of the shaming self-talk bullshit. And to actually build mastery in that, I think of golfers, I'm a golfer, but I don't know that I'd be qualified to like give any advice on golf because I shoot kind of in the 90s or, you know, or low hundreds, but I find it's so easy to get derailed by a bad shot. And you know, the being able to master the thought process, you're right. I mean, it has to be the difference. But the top five, I mean, I look at someone like Novak Djokovic and I'm like, this guy's been a master forever. And he can rebound from being down two sets and then come back and crush it.
Yeah. And then it's something positive is going on inside his head that's deactivating the negativity from being down. And it fascinates me. I'm looking, and you start seeing it show up. If you start looking for it, you start seeing it show up in all aspects of human behavior. And to me, it's one of the latest things. I told you there's endless novelty. This is the thing that I'm, how do you negotiate with yourself? It's a question I get all the time. As a general rule, we're great against negotiating against ourselves. I can't do this. This is hard. This might go bad. I can't say that. They'll reject it. Our ability to negotiate against ourselves is phenomenal. So can we flip that around and produce great relationships, including our romantic relationships? I think we can. I ain't saying it's easy, but I think it's absolutely within grasp.
There's something sacred about your bed. It's a place where you return after a hard day, where you reflect, where you heal, where you make love, where you cry, where you dream, where you sleep, or where you just breathe. And the truth is, we often overlook how important it is to feel held by the space that we sleep in. That's why I have been continuously obsessed with Cozy Earth. These sheets, they're not just soft, they're buttery, they're cooling, and sustainably made from bamboo viscose. It's like sliding into a cloud that whispers, hey, you're safe here. And that matters. Because nervous systems that feel safe, they open, they receive, they rest. We can manage emotional experiences in our lives. So sleep isn't just sleep, it's repair. And Cozy Earth gives you the kind of sleep your soul has been craving. Now here's the best part. Cozy Earth is offering my listeners up to 40% off. That's right, 40% off. Because deep rest shouldn't be a luxury. It should be a lifestyle. So if you're ready to transform your relationship with rest, go to CozyEarth.com and use the code MARK at checkout. You will feel the difference that these sheets make. That is for certain. And remember, you are allowed to feel that good. So that's fascinating. If you negotiate against yourself, how could you be a positive negotiator relationally? Like, wouldn't you lack confidence and lack the skill set even in navigating and finding positive outcomes even in your own mind? You know what I mean?
Well, how do you defeat yourself? How in a relationship, how are you likely to defeat yourself? And I'm scared to say this. Or since I don't know how to say it, I'm going to keep it from them and hope it goes away.
Yeah.
Or, I'll tell them a lie because it'll make them feel good. Now, that doesn't mean you need to be brutally honest. But you can be conscious of, are you saying things that are repetitive that seem inauthentic because you've repeated them so many times? Or what sort of bad communication habits have you picked up from your parents? How did your parents talk to you that you felt was reassuring and interested, and in point of fact, it's dismissive? So, and I think there's a lot of interesting things there. If your principal core focus is, I want us to always be excited by one another. Mm-hmm. If that's the chatter in your head, you're probably going to be all right.
I'm curious about calibrated questions, about like, how do we use these questions in romantic or interpersonal relationships? You talk about starting with how and what. And so how could we use these questions as a way of transforming difficult conversations in our romantic relationships?
Well, the critical issue to any how or what question, and those are the only questions and no oriented questions. Are you against doing this? Don't try to get people to say yes. Are you against going to the Cheesecake Factory tonight? Well, no, I'm not against going to cheese, but I'd rather go here. You get a quicker answer. The other person feels involved and empowered with a no-oriented question. But how and what? You got to listen to the answer. And you got to show that you listen. Like, how was your day? If you don't listen, if I don't feel heard on the answer, then I'm going to say, I forget. And I think this is one of the things, a bad habit we pick up from our parents, a well-intentioned bad habit. It's routine that your teenagers won't talk to you. Teenager comes home, how was your day? Fine. What'd you learn from it? I forget. Well, because you didn't listen to when you asked them, how was their day? The first time you asked them that, they answered you. And you immediately went to what did you learn from it? Spending no time whatsoever on showing that you actually heard and understood what they said to the answer, how was your day? So you did this 4, 5, 6 times to your teenager, and you showed them you weren't listening. So why should they bother answering an exhausting question? How was your day? If I spent all the time answering and you didn't bother listening, I ain't gonna answer again. But then you learn that, you reflect on it as an adult. This is how your mom showed interest in your life. So you translate that behavior to your romantic partner. How was your day? You don't listen to the answer. That's why your romantic partner is going to be like, I don't know, I forget. It's a long day. Leave me alone. You know, man, let me watch TV. Make me a sandwich. Let me watch TV.
If someone makes a bid to you and you do not respond to that bid over and over again, then eventually you're just going to give up. Eventually you're just going to
condition the person that you're not listening. We condition each other regularly every day.
Yeah. So the opposite of that would be to tactically sounds manipulative, but not manipulative, but like to tactically respond. Or do you eventually just relationally have to create enough evidence to an alternate story where you have to be relentless in order to change the unconscious in the other person? Do you know what I mean?
Wow. There's a lot to that question. First of all, let's go back to you tactically. Is that manipulation?
Yeah.
All right. So it depends upon where you're going. Is charm manipulation? Like if your significant other, and I'll say, you know, female in this case, she's spent a lot of time making herself beautiful to go out. And you say, hey, you look beautiful. It's genuine appreciation. Is that manipulative? It was charming, but genuine appreciation. So is your empathy genuine? Is your listening? Are your compliments? And it not only is it genuine, but again, the difference between manipulation and influence, where you're trying to go with them. I'm a believer in long-term relationships of trust. So I'm going to walk my talk. And yeah, I want us to have a great relationship forever. And so that's influence. I'm going to compliment you because I want you to feel appreciated. I want you to enjoy being around me. So the real difference there is, where am I taking you with it? Am I complimenting you because I want to exploit you? That's manipulation. But if I'm complimenting you to create a better collaboration between the two of us, that's influence, and it's completely acceptable.
I like that. So can people unconsciously pick up on the difference in those? Like, do we pick up on facial cues and just tonality and energetic when we're picking up on a lack of sincerity?
Well, yeah, there's, and then it's context. You know, it's not just a facial cue. And that's where a lot of the body language guidance is just off. Because I, again, on Huberman Lab's podcast, he's interviewing somebody, the body language psychologist, and she said, like, you know, if I got a frown on my face, I could be unhappy with you, or I could have gas. And then there are those of us, like I have the resting serial killer look. Like if I'm listening intently to you, I'm looking at you like you think I'm planning on chopping you up and serving you with fava beans and a nice Chianti.
I didn't want to say anything, but I was feeling that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so in a romantic relationship, we talked before about people having a lot of exposure to us. Now they've got a pretty good beat on our context.
Yeah.
And so then, yeah, then facial cues, tone of voice combined with context, their gut instinct is picking up on what's going on, which is the gut instinct is this insane supercomputer, like insane. Your gut instinct, your subconscious processes 500,000 more pieces of information per second than your conscious mind does. There's a 500,000-to-1 ratio there. And so in a long-term relationship, our significant other's got all this data to process for good or for bad. So that's why you got to walk the talk.
Yeah, when we think about then changing the data set, right? Like all our, because if I'm wanting to create a positive frame of reference to me when I've formally maybe not responded to their bids and the requests. And so now I'm trying to change that in their brain. I'm creating sincere and authentic tactical plans on how to do that by complimenting them, etc. It seems to be like on some level, humans, we have such a negativity bias that like how, I'm not sure if you would know this, but it's like, how long does it actually take for a human to actually unconsciously, will they eventually change their frame of mind if we build enough evidence?
Well, let me throw this idea out as a concept. You know, they say it takes about 3 weeks to build a new habit. And I heard a stat from Blue Angel pilot, which I think is either the Navy's or the Air Force, you know, exhibition pilots, where they're flying around at Mach 1 and their wings are 3 feet apart.
That's bananas.
So they don't learn how to do that up in the air. They got to build those habits on the ground with practice, with rehearsal, with intention. And this particular pilot says it takes about 63 to 64 repetitions to build a habit. And if you're doing it, you know, how many times per day, then you end up with about 3 weeks. So my guess to your answer is if there isn't an instantaneous change, you need to demonstrate some behavior for about 3 weeks or so. And those 3 weeks are going to go by anyway.
Right.
And so then you begin to slowly change your own behavior. Habits have momentum, you know, build it in small ways. And then you got some behavior that the other side is going to start to pick up on. And if suddenly you're a nice person, they'll be like, ah,
yeah,
what'd you do wrong?
Yeah, totally.
But if you've been nice for about 3 weeks, they're like, oh, wow, you know, maybe this is the new normal. So you got to give people a chance. You got to sustain it to build the habit. And forgive yourself for not being perfect. Strive for excellence and give yourself about, you know, three-ish weeks. See what happens.
I mean, you're right. It's going to go by anyway, so you might as well transform your relationship in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. There's
And then make it fun. I mean, great relationships are a lot of fun. And as you said before, we have a negativity bias. I think as a layman, I'll lay out my reasoning. And my neuroscientist brothers and sisters would be like, all right, so your conclusion is correct, but how you got there is all wrong. And I'd be like, okay, I don't care as long as I'm on the right track.
I got there. So it doesn't matter.
And so the brain's 75% negative. Survival mode, what we've inherited from the caveman, is negative. Because in the caveman days, a negative thing would kill us. And if we lived through it the first time, we probably wouldn't live through it the second time. Positive things don't kill us. You know, we go around all day ignoring positive stuff. It's not going to kill us. But ignoring the negative, if it wasn't fatal the first time, the second or third time it is. Mm-hmm. So to just survive, our default survival mode is highly negative. So we got to get in there with, I refer to it as mental hygiene. What's the analogy? Did I brush my teeth this morning? Well, wait a minute. I brushed them yesterday. You mean I got to do it again today? Yeah. Not only do I got to do it, you probably got to do it twice a day. Because our natural default mode takes over, and you know everybody around us going to know if we haven't brushed our teeth.
That's for sure.
So you know, do mental hygiene, do positive hygiene, stay with it, pay attention to your chatter, and pretty soon it'll become the habit, and you'll override the negativity.
How do you see the concept of mirroring being really helpful in couples?
Well, all right. So let's talk. There's two kinds of mirroring. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the traditional body language mirroring, which many people weaponize.
Yeah.
So we're sensitive to it. Now, a hostage negotiator is a black swan. A black swan method of mirroring is just repeating the last 1 to 3 words of what somebody said. It is not mimicking. It is not mimicking their body language, their tone of voice, any of that stuff. Now, it is also at the same time true that the more in sync you get in the moment, you are going to start to pick up the other person's body language inadvertently. Mm-hmm. Now, that's okay if it's become a natural flow. But so many manipulative types, start mirroring body language. That the minute I see somebody pick it up on me, I will make a couple moves to see whether or not it's authentic.
Interesting. How do you differentiate?
I'll just start. How long we've been talking? Do I find myself in sync with them? So then, if I make a change and they immediately do the same change, there's a pretty good chance it's inauthentic. It's a little bit like, you know, I used to work surveillance when I was with the FBI, and which makes me highly conscious of somebody following me.
Yeah.
If I'm wondering if you're following me, I'm going to make a turn. You make that turn, then pretty soon I'm going to make the second turn. You make that second turn, I'm hitting the brakes. You're probably going to rear end me because I know you're following me inauthentically. So I'll change my body language. If you follow me twice, then you're hustling.
And that is, I think, taught in NLP, right? That type of, I forget what they call it, pacing and
mirroring. It probably is.
Yeah.
I've heard there are a couple different schools of thought that I've heard. There's a tremendous amount of overlap with the Black Swan method. NLP is one of them. And to me, if you're trying to communicate authentically, you're going to find overlap in other fields of study, which then if you find it in more than one place, it's probably a universal principle. Take a close look at it and decide what you think.
So how would the method you're talking about in terms of sentences, repeating the first two or three words, what would that maybe sound like?
What would it sound like?
Yeah, like that.
Like that?
Yeah. So that's...
It's the last... You start with the last words. And then it's the tone of voice. Because if you're not used to it, you'll do it robotically. And then somebody will know that you're doing something different. Like we see this all the time in intimate relationships. A man or woman has learned the Black Swan method, and they learn mirroring. So then you think you're going to get caught. So the last three words, you repeat it in a monotone voice. She picks up on it right away. Not because you mirrored, but because it was your tone of voice. Mm-hmm. Now, the flip side is two people that have been longtime fans of the book from the very early days, very, very, very smart people. The husband, then fiance, became husband, is being coached by my son, Brandon. And Brandon says, use the stuff at home. So after about 3 or 4 days, the fiance goes, I really like talking to you. What's different? And he says, look, I'm studying this book and it's about authentic connection and communication. And she went out and bought the book for all of her girlfriends, boyfriends, and husbands. And so then what we tell people is like, tell your spouse, look, I'm trying to be a better listener. And here are the tools that I've been given so that I can be a better listener for you with me. So, it's going to sound different. And here's my objective so that we're closer. And then the spouse is cool with that. And if she's not cool with it, he or she or whoever's on the other side, if your intention to use the skills is to be a better listener, to be there more for them, and they don't like that, well, that's a sign of a whole different color.
Yeah, there's other books to help with that.
Yeah.
Well, as I was saying to you before we hit record, I was at a conference this past weekend, and the keynote, he said, if there's one book everyone should read, it was yours. And I was like, I'm interviewing him on Monday. This is insane. Like, what were the chances? And I loved it. I wanted to tell you that because I was just like, what a great to know that your work has touched so many people in so many industries in so many ways. And to know that we can use, this is about building exceptional skills as being a communicator. And why wouldn't we all want more of that? Like if I ask 100 people, what's the most important skill set for a relationship, 99% will say communication.
Yeah. And the key to communication is more accurate listening. It's not being more articulate. And I was talking to a business executive a couple of years ago, and he's saying, like, now that I'm delegating negotiations to people that work for me, me and my other senior executives are watching this stuff fall apart over miscommunication only, not disagreement, misunderstanding. And I said, yeah, but it's not because people are failing to articulate. It's because people are failing to actually listen, analyze, think about what's being said. And so it's bad listening. It's not bad articulation.
You know that moment when you land in a new country and you open your phone and nothing? No data, no maps, no way to let anyone know that you've arrived. You're stuck wandering around the airport searching for Wi-Fi or trying to figure out how to buy a local SIM. Usually while jet-lagged and juggling luggage, it's not exactly the dream start to a trip, is it? That's where something like Saily can make a big difference. It's an app that offers eSIM data plans in over 190 countries. So instead of scrambling for a connection, you're online the minute you land. No SIM cards, no waiting in lines, no awkward language barrier at the phone shop. And because it's an eSIM, you only need to install it once. So if you're hopping between countries, you don't have to switch anything out. You just choose a regional or global plan in the app and you're good to go. There are even security features built in, like changing your virtual location or blocking malicious ads, so you can browse with a little more peace of mind too. So whether you're traveling for work, adventure, or just getting out of town for a bit, it's worth checking out.
Get an exclusive 15% discount on Saily data plans. Use code MARKGROVES at checkout. Download the Saily app or go to www.saily.com/MARKGROVES. You've negotiated with hostage takers. You've negotiated with so many different challenging people and challenging circumstances. I am curious. This is the one question I was like, I gotta hear what you have to say on this. What similarities have you observed between these high stakes negotiations and these emotional standoffs compared to like romantic relationships?
There isn't the effects of feeling heard, feeling understood is impossible to resist. It's impossible to not be triggered by. It's not impossible to not be touched by. You know, I often say, does empathy work on sociopaths? Yes, it does. Why? How could that be? Well, or narcissists, you know, in relationships, you know, that's the word of the day, topic of the day. They're narcissists. Well, and here's why it works. Being feeling heard works. There's a hypothesis out there that you're born with five basic emotions. And only one of those five is positive. It's anger, disgust, delight, sadness, unhappiness. Yeah, I can't remember off the top of my head. You know, I should, because I say this all the time. But you're born with these five emotions, period. Now, the only argument I've seen on that is there's not five, there's six, or there's 10. And it's not joy, it's happiness. People want to quibble over the terminology, but I'm not seeing any quibbling over whether or not you're born with emotions, just because you're human. Now, the narcissist, the sociopath, the negative types, are created as a result of their interaction with the world. They were still born with these core emotions. They were still born with basic neurochemistry. And the feeling of being heard, the feeling of being understood, triggers neurochemicals. So the narcissist, the sociopath, and the sociopath in particular, they're not born without emotions. They don't have guilt. They may not believe in morality. That's a result of their interaction with life after they were born with these core emotions. So that's the one thing I found to be universally true. Even somebody's on a spectrum, you know, what was it, the movie The Accountant with Ben Affleck was mm-hmm. a great example of a dude on the spectrum. They still love being understood. Like that guy loved numbers.
Yeah.
Well, he's got emotions. You know, everybody's got these emotions that they came to planet Earth with. So that's why this stuff works universally on all human beings. You have an impact.
So if you're willing to ask good questions and enter into an empathic attempt, I guess, to attempt to empathize, how do you hold the line where you're not giving access to someone like a narcissist or a sociopath? Like, how do you still maintain differentiation? Because I'm sure a lot of people are, let's say, co-parenting, divorced, or their partner currently is a narcissist. Maybe not clinical, but Instagram diagnosed.
Yes. Well, the fine line you got to draw in your head,
yeah,
is that understanding is not agreement. And that's the way I conduct myself, which gives me the ability to influence anyone on planet Earth. To be curious about where they're coming from, I can fully understand anybody without agreeing with anything that they say.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, disagreeing with all of them, but I know the impact it's going to have on you as a human being if I demonstrate to you that I simply understand. And you get a lot of freedom from that. It gives you the opportunity to use this superpower on everybody. It also gives you the opportunity to learn from everybody. You shouldn't be afraid to learn from anybody, even the most despicable human being. You got to know how they tick. You should be curious about how they tick, how they manipulate, the approach, what are their tells, what are the things that tip off where they're going, what they're doing. You should be, if you're genuinely curious, which also is impossible to resist. Like if I'm dealing with a narcissist and I'm genuinely curious, like they're going to give me a ton of information. Now, yeah, they're going to test me along the way. But I drew that line early on in my brain saying like, no, I don't agree. I never said I agreed. And if you're trying to pretend like my agreement or my understanding is agreement, then actually that's a really good sign about you. So if you can draw that line is a real key issue. Understanding is not agreement. Curiosity is not weakness. Is not giving in. It's being curious.
Feels like the world could use a lot of that advice right now in terms of maintaining or exploring difference. You know.
Oh yeah, and we are encouraged to do the opposite on the media and social media.
Yeah,
politically, it doesn't matter what the agenda is of the social media, whether they're on the left or on the right.
Right.
You know, they make more money the angrier we are.
Yeah, this is, who would have thought that this would be the very act of rebellion, you know, on some level to maintain a state of curiosity. And I love how you differentiated, like just because you understand someone, it actually means that you're listening, but it doesn't mean that you're like, yay, I now agree with everything you say. I'm curious, for so many people in relationship are people pleasers, right? They compromise their own needs, wants, emotions in order to maintain connection. A lot of that learned from childhood. How is it possible for someone who is conflict avoidant in that way to actually be a good negotiator relationally?
Once you're conflict avoidant, you start to take yourself hostage.
Mm.
And so a lot of it is, what is your definition of conflict? And really, is it, where do you see it taking? You know, vision drives decision. Our vision of the future drives decision. I believe that genuine conflict has the ability to produce beautiful outcomes.
Yeah, I agree.
Genuine disagreement. Now, I'm not talking about physical conflict.
Yeah.
And I, you know, we came very close to putting this up on Instagram recently, because in my book, that's exactly what I say. You know, genuine differences of opinion, if it's genuine and you're looking to collaborate, create better outcomes. So the verbal conflict, if we're trying to struggle with people. So that's my definition of conflict, is that it produces better outcomes. And human nature actually backs that up. Human history, creativity, necessity being the mother of invention, you know, all these different cliches, they come from different differences of opinion, people sharing with one another to create better things. So if you're conflict avoidant, you're denying yourself more beautiful outcomes. Mm. You're denying yourself the learning opportunities. You're denying yourself being corrected over your misunderstandings by being conflict avoidant. This gets back to what I was saying before, that most people are great at negotiating against themselves. you know, I can't bring this up. It'll destroy the relationship. You've just taken yourself hostage and you've just imprisoned yourself. And the relationship's coming to an end eventually anyway.
Yeah, agreed.
So maybe it should.
Yeah.
Maybe you're with the wrong person because the wrong person is holding you back from the right person.
And you really do diminish the value of your own contribution to what is trying to be worked through and understood through the relationship. And I think...
Well said.
Well, it's interesting too, because I see so many of the, let's say, the most hot button subjects currently in media, all of it, in culture. And it doesn't seem like there's space for both perspectives to coexist. It's like, if you believe that, then you're this. If you believe that, then you're this. And I saw this a lot during, you know, obviously, I think everyone saw it a lot during COVID, that families were broken apart by these and relationships. I mean, I know couples that broke up because of a difference of opinion. But what I noticed a lot was how, this was my experience, other people might disagree, but I noticed a lot with public health and politicians is that there was a moralizing of one way. And I'm curious, as soon as you moralize something, what does that do to the ability to dialogue? Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, it destroys it. Nobody's ever 100% right. There's a line that from Bill Clinton that I love from back when he was in the middle of trying to resolve things between Israel and Palestine, Middle East peace negotiations in the 90s. At one point in time, he says, no one has a monopoly on virtue or tears. Mm-hmm. And now that's insightful.
That's a good line.
Yeah. And so if you can take that approach, if you're willing to admit that you don't have the monopoly on virtue or tears, and you're willing to give that to the other side also, the fact that you have agreed to that about yourself, it tends to trigger reciprocity. Because you're not moralizing at them. You know, I'm not perfect. I don't have a monopoly on virtue. And if you lead in that, I don't have a monopoly on tears either. You know, you recognize that they've suffered tears, and that it kind of requires them to recognize that you suffered tears as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's the approach that's really lost, because much of what happens in social media, people are trying to claim monopoly or trying to inflict difficulty when there may not be any.
So when a couple hears the title of your book, Never Split the Difference, I'm curious, how does one take the premise of that into conflict, into conversation, and I guess do it from a place where there's like a sense of a successful compromise? Because both are probably thinking, I would like to get more my way or more some way. Or I have an outcome, which I know you talked about before, about being intention. So how does a couple navigate that? It seems like a paradox.
It does. And that's the only shortcoming. And it's unavoidable to have a title that hasn't got some shortcomings.
yeah, fair enough.
You know, it's
but
impossible.
It's a snappy title. It's a good title. It worked.
Tal Roz came over, the co-writer of the book, Tal's a genius, and he came up with that. The fairness issue, the F bomb.
Yeah.
if I want you to potentially be willing to accept that I'm 100% right, I got to be willing to accept that you could be 100% right. So let me get my ego out of my way. My favorite negotiation, I think this is perfect for us to draw to a conclusion on. Negotiation between a husband and a wife over a Christmas tree. Husband's in my class at Georgetown, and I'm requiring people to write up their negotiations, a very specific format. Tell me what went down point by point. So the husband wants an artificial tree for all the practical reasons. You know, you buy it once, you always know what it's going to look like, and we don't got to go searching for a new tree every year. It's not going to catch on fire. You know, the dog's not going to mark it when he comes by. You know, all these practical reasons. And the wife is just not hearing it. She's being very, quote, emotional. So he decides to use one of the skills. He's thinking about it because we ask people to think about it in depth. Think about what's behind. Dig deep. And a skill is a label. So he's thinking like, well, you know, if she's really hanging on to this and not talking to him about it at all, it must be something in her history. So he says to her, seems like he had real trees growing up. Now, he uses this skill in order to get his way. But the seems like label triggers thinking in both sides. It increases. If you start labeling, your analysis, your ability to hear increases. And as soon as he says that, she says, yeah, she says, I got such memories around a Christmas tree. The smell of a real tree reminds me of the celebration of the holidays and how close our family was around the holidays. And that smell, and I want our children to have those same memories. Bang. He's convinced they buy a real tree. They didn't split the difference. He found out why the counterpart wanted what they wanted without asking why in an accusatory way. Notice he did not say, why do you want a real tree? He used a label. Seems like he had real trees growing up. And bang, it opened up everything. Mm. And that is never splitting the difference. Find out where the other side's coming from. Their motives and their end goal may be better than yours. You got to keep yourself open to that.
Mm. That's beautiful. I'm going to have to think about that when the tree time comes around our house, because that conversation has happened. Chris, yeah, and thank you so much for your time. Thank you for dropping these nuggets of knowledge. And I love the overlap of your work. I think it's just so incredible for all of us to learn these skills. So I really appreciate you taking the time. Where can people find more of you?
Yeah, well, blackswanltd.com is a website. And we've got a bunch of cool stuff coming up. You know, I'm glad this is a relationship-oriented podcast. We have a negotiation retreat in the fall just for women. And amazing. It's kind of the only thing that I'm willing to do for a demographic. And I don't even get to go. The female coaches on my team, Sandy Hine, has led the effort, and we got several females. They didn't even let me show up. It's women only, and it's a really cool thing. They have the best time together. So come to the website. We got something for training wherever you are. We can help you get better in whatever relationship you want to work on. And for women especially, we've got a few things carved out just for them. Again, that's the only demographic that I'm willing to do something specific for, and it's the women's retreat in the fall, and they love it. It's something I'm very proud of, and they don't even let me go.
Sounds like they've got some good boundaries around their negotiations.
I'm willing to say go for it. And so, yeah, I'm very supportive of it.
That's awesome. And for all of you listening or watching, we only scratched the surface of the depths of Chris's work. So make sure you go pick up the book, the audio book as well. And Chris, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, Mark, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.